Once again this morning, we'll be giving people who are listening the opportunity to talk with a candidate who is seeking his party's nomination to run for the U.S. Senate from Illinois. One of our senators, Republican Peter Fitzgerald, is not running for re-election, so we have an open seat. And a crowded field of candidates on both sides, both Republican and Democrat, will be competing in the Illinois primary on March 16th. We issued invitations to all of the candidates, said if you're interested, we have a show. You could be on the program and talk with people here downstate. And a number of them, sad to say not all, but a number of them did take up the opportunity. And we'll be talking with another one of these candidates this morning. His name is Chiranjeev Katuria. He is one of the Republicans. And he is joining us by telephone, and I'm sure would be happy to take whatever questions people might have. Just a little bit about him in terms of biography, and then we can get some more. He was born in India, but did his growing up here in the United States, and in fact, up in DuPage County in the Chicago area. Went to Downers Grove North High School. He earned undergraduate and medical degrees from Brown University. Also has an MBA from Stanford. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who are listening can call with questions. We just ask callers to be brief, just so we can keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But, of course, questions are certainly welcome. Again, 333-9455. That's for here in Champaign-Urbana, but any place else in the state. If it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. Mr. Katuria, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. And you can hear us all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Telling me, just to start out, why do you want to run for Senate?
You know, I think my parents came to this country 40 years ago, and can you hear me?
Yes.
They came to this country 40 years ago with not that much money. And, you know, I was basically able to go to Downers Grove North High School, earning, you know, as you said, an undergraduate and medical degree from Brown, an MBA from Stanford, and made a $55,000 investment in a company called the Extreme Network, and it was sold for $75 million. You know, and when I kind of think about it, it was really because of the opportunities and freedoms that America had given me and my family. It was really living the American dream. And this was, you know, my way of giving back to this great country, what it gave to me and my family, and then using my experiences in building small businesses, being the only physician in both parties trying to look at solving some of the problems with healthcare, and then a little bit using my experiences in space commercialization to fight the war on terror, I thought we could bring a lot to the U.S. Senate and to the United States. Mm.
I'm curious because you do have the medical degree from Brown, but as far as I know, you've never actually practiced medicine. I wonder why it is that having gone through med school, you then decided you weren't going to be a doctor.
Yeah, no, that's you know, a good question. I think for me, I was always interested in healthcare policy. I did an independent concentration at Brown in healthcare policy. While I went to Stanford, I studied with Professor Allen and Tovin, looking at the managed competition proposal. And I guess as fate had it, I met a friend of mine in business school who wanted to go to India and, you know, build a cell phone company when India was on the verge of bankruptcy. And as I went over to India, I got involved in building companies and never really had the chance to come back and practice medicine. It was probably more just a twist of fate than anything else. Hmm. But I loved medicine. I was actually admitted to medical school while I was in high school. I wrote a research paper back then.
Hmm. Well, forgive me, this is going to sound like a negative question and not really intended to be so negative, but according to an article that was published in the Chicago Tribune last year, at the time that you filed for your candidacy, you weren't registered to vote and never had been. Would it be a mistake to think that that's an indication of lack of interest in politics on your part?
I think there's, you know, a couple things. You know, I think 70% of most people don't vote, you know, in a primary. And I think, you know, we wanted to get more involved in the political process than just in terms of voting, is actually giving back to America what America gave to us. In terms of putting my own money into the race, I put the third amount of my own money into the race, you know, after Blair Hall, after Jack Ryan. And more importantly, if you know, if you look at Senator Frist, who's now the Senate Majority Leader and who might run for president in 2008, he didn't vote till he was, you know, 36 or 37, my age. So, and probably, you know, the same with some of the other leaders, including Dick Cheney. So probably some of the greatest leaders of our time, you know, have had, you know, the same thing. And, you know, absolutely, I wish I'd got involved earlier in the political process. But not only am I getting involved in the political process, you know, I'm getting a lot of people who haven't, you know, normally taken part in the political process and registering tens of thousands of other voters to take place and get involved.
So you are registered to vote now?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So at least a candidate ought to be able to count on at least one vote, and that's their own.
Well, hopefully a lot more. We just got the Independent Voters Association, which is the third largest voting bloc in Illinois that represents 900,000 voters, and they endorsed our candidacy. Also, if you take a look at the Republican primary, the last time a Republican won an open seat was in 1928. And if we just look at the statistics, there are 700,000 Republican primary voters. There are 479,000 Asian Americans, 950,000 registered African Americans, and over 700,000 Hispanic voters. And since we're the only minority running in the Republican Party and the only Asian American, ironically, we'd probably have the best shot of holding the seat because we can get the independent voters, which we got their endorsement. We're the only Asian American, and each of those voting blocks alone is equivalent to the number of the Republican primary voters. So, you know, it's like that song from Evita, I tell the Republican Party, I kept my promise, now don't keep your distance.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Chirinjeev Khatoria. He is a Republican who will be among those running in the primary on March 16th, and of course one of them will go on to represent their party in the general election. And here, as we've done now for many years on the program, in the run-up to both primaries and general elections, we've had as many candidates on the show as we're interested. So he is here to answer questions. I can ask questions, but of course reporters get to talk with candidates all the time. The idea of this program is that if people who are listening have questions, whatever issue is most important to them, they can call and have some direct contact with the candidate. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I have tried to ask some basic questions of all the candidates we have been talking with, and maybe I'll start out with health care, since this is something that, because you have that medical background, I know that you're particularly interested in. We do have a serious issue in this country, and that is it's estimated that there are more than 43 million Americans who don't have any health insurance. What should we do about that?
I think, Dave, it's a good question. Since I'm the only physician in the race and I studied healthcare policy, this is one of the major focuses of our campaign. So let's look at what are the problems in healthcare, you know, then kind of break it down and look at what are some possible solutions, you know, that we've thought about and that people have talked about. The first issue is if you own a small business, you pay health insurance. It's extremely expensive. And how do you make it affordable for employers so they can compete globally? The second issue is if you work part-time, health insurance again becomes very expensive. The third issue is, you know, prescription drugs. The fourth issue is tort reform. And the fifth issue, as you talked about, is, you know, the uninsured. So with the small businesses, there's got to be either buying groups or groups where they can buy health insurance at a much more affordable cost for the employees. If you work part-time, you should be able to buy health insurance deducted from your taxes as the same as if you had paid, you know, working for a Fortune 500 company. With prescription drugs, you know, I think Bush's Medicare proposal is a step in the right direction, but we would also allow the importation of drugs from Canada. We were one of the first candidates to talk about that. With malpractice and tort reform, you know, we would put a cap of $250,000 on pain and suffering. And more importantly, the uninsured, which, you know, a lot of the Democratic candidates are talking about, and to my knowledge, none of the Republican candidates are talking about it except for us. Being a doctor, if you get really sick, you enter your emergency room is the only time you enter your emergency room because no doctor will see you. So let's say if you develop pneumonia, you go to the emergency room, and you might stay in the hospital. It might cost you $2,000 or $3,000. I would give tax vouchers, tax credits, so the uninsured could, you know, buy health insurance, and let's say before they got sick, they could go visit, you know, a physician, get amoxicillin or penicillin, which might only cost $20 or $30. So, and then I think those are, you know, issues that we need to look at in starting to reform our healthcare system. You know, I believe everyone has a right to affordable, high-quality healthcare. I just think the combination of a government and private healthcare system is the best way to deliver it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that people are very concerned about now is the cost of prescription medications. And you said that you would favor people being able to get their medicines in Canada. Do you think that the federal government should be doing anything, should put any sort of a pressure on the drug manufacturers to lower the cost of their products?
You know, I think, you know, in a competitive system, I think, you know, if you bring in drugs from Canada, automatically the competitive forces will result in prices being lowered. I don't think you I don't believe, in price controls or anything along those lines. I think the competitive, nature of our landscape is probably the best way to bring the cost of prescription drugs under control. If you can bring a drug from Canada, the same type of drug, and sell it in the U.S. for 40 or 50% lower, pharmaceutical manufacturers will drop the price of drugs. Or with the Bush's proposal, if they want to fund part of the cost for senior citizens, I also think that's a great idea.
Mm. On the economy, more generally, there is still a lot of concern about how things are going, the slowness of the recovery from the recession, the fact that, as Democrats like to point out, a couple of million jobs have been lost since the president took office. We are adding new jobs, but at a very slow rate, and at the rate we're going, it'll take a long time just to get back to the point where we were. What do you think the government should be doing or can do to stimulate the economy?
I think, let's take a look. I remember when I was at business school in Stanford, my professor wrote a basic equation, revenues minus cost equal profits. So here, we've got to figure out how do we increase revenues for the government. Small businesses have generally generated a majority of job growth in this country. So what you need to do with small businesses, you need to stimulate them and grow them because they're going to add the most number of jobs for Illinoisans and the rest of the United States. So first, you've got to give them tax cuts. And you got to keep the Bush tax cuts permanent. For example, from capital gains, the estate debt tax, and as we talked about, making health insurance for their employees more affordable. Also, what you need to do to help small businesses grow, you need to help them expand outside the U.S. For example, if you're a small business owner and you have 6 or 7 employees and you want to sell your goods to, let's say, India or Africa or the U.K., you just don't have a marketing department. You don't know who to call. For example, the Indian cellular industry is growing by 20%, yet Singular and AT&T are merging because there's consolidation in the industry. This allows Motorola to, build more radio stations, sell more software to India, and employ more people in Illinois. The second thing, the second thing, what I would do for companies, bigger companies that are located overseas, I would give them a 1-year tax forgiveness that they would be taxed at 5% instead of 35% if they located back to the U.S. That would bring in over $300 billion into the economy. Next, you got to take a look at the cost side and what you should do. I think there's a couple of things that you should do. One is you got to look at the big entitlement programs. I mean, there are a lot of people who paid into Social Security, and they deserve to get their money back and get a reasonable rate of return. But if you look at the facts of Social Security, a 38-year-old African-American gentleman will actually lose money in Social Security. A normal person paying into Social Security will only get a 1.3% rate of return. It's already going to end up with a $9 trillion deficit. What a lot of Americans don't appreciate is when you pay money into Social Security, it's basically an IOU. They don't take that money and sit there and invest it in a bank. So basically, you've got to create personal retirement accounts where they get a 5% rate of return and create basically a nest egg that they can pass on to their kids. Because the entitlement programs are a big part of the budget. We've got to talk about reforming Medicare. Only 12% of the people are in Medicare into a private health care system. We need to move more of them into a private health care system. So, you got to look at the big entitlement programs. Then, in terms of the smaller programs, I would, have a balanced budget amendment, where and for other, special interest programs, basically a vote or up or down. And a proposal that I'm working on that, a friend of mine gave a lot of money to CDC, and he was able to deduct it off his taxes, which, kind of makes a lot of sense. So some of these smaller programs like the Eisenhower Math and Science program that a lot of, philanthropists might want to give to, they can deduct it off their taxes. Those are things I would start to do. I would keep the tax cuts permanent. I wouldn't decrease tax anymore. I would work now on balancing the budget.
There seems to be still a serious problem with spending, the government spending. There's only so much apparently we can increase revenue, and it seems that people go to the Washington, both Democrats and Republicans. Everybody talks about controlling spending and controlling the size of government, but at the same time, it seems that everybody's got something that they want funded, and often find ways to get it done. And some people would say, well, you know what we really have to do is we have to spend less. But then you get to the question, well, okay, if you want to cut some of our spending now, where do you do it? I mean, do you see places where you think government spending really should be cut?
I mean there are certain areas where, you know, you could I think, you know, you've got to look at where are you going to, you know, where are you going to cut? I think basically it's the big entitlement program. You can look at $10 million stuff, $100 million, you know, different programs. But I really think if you're looking at, you know, just, you know, in size of proportions, Social Security and Medicare are in the billions of dollars. So I think that's where the system needs reform. But I think in order to cut spending, what you got to do is put a balanced budget amendment and have up or down votes. I think that's what makes the most sense.
Back to Social Security, when President Bush was running for office, he talked about taking younger people as they're coming into the system and giving them the opportunity to take some of that money that they pay into Social Security and to put that into a self-directed kind of retirement fund with some restrictions about what could happen to that. And I know that you've touched on that. Another number of Republicans think that that would be a good idea. Other people, I think, are very concerned about the issue of whether that money would be secure. And in fact, they point to what's happened with the boom and the bust in the stock market over the last decade or so and say something like, you know, well, if that had been in effect, the people who had put their money into mutual funds, they would have lost a lot of money and they wouldn't be ahead. They would be in trouble.
Now, you know, I think it's a good question. So I think we need to understand the proposal first. First of all, let's look. Today, the senior citizen is averaging only a 1.3% rate of return on their contribution. As we mentioned, an African-American gentleman who's 38 is going to lose money on Social Security. So what we're saying is we create Social Security Part B, which is entirely voluntary. So, you know, I think the claim that we're forcing young people into a risky investment that jeopardizes their benefits, the proposal that I'm looking at is not true. You just have a voluntary Social Security Part B. And what it does is basically allow you to put your investments into super safe treasuries or stock index funds. And historically, those have always, you know, grown. And you're at least going to get, you know, a 5% rate of return. And more importantly, you know, if you put, let's say, that money into an account over 40 years, that, you know, that the person works, that would give a much higher generous retirement benefit than what Social Security promises. So if a younger person puts it into account, let's say a super safe treasury or a treasury bond, which is purely voluntary, they're not being forced to do it, and over 40 years, that account will grow significantly.
We have a caller, and I'd certainly welcome other people who are listening into the program here. If you'd like to talk with our guest, Chiranjeev Kachuria, he is one of the Republicans that will be competing in the primary here in Illinois March 16th, and one of them will go on to represent their party in the general election in the race for the United States Senate. One of our senators, Republican Pete Fitzgerald, is not running again, so we have an open seat here, and we have a very large field on both sides, both Republicans and Democrats, and we've had a number of them on the program. To give you a chance to talk with them, and you can do that here today. We do have a caller here ready to go in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I had a question on workers' compensation insurance. That's usually expensive for a small business owner. Do you see any possibility of making some adjustments there in any kind of health care reform?
Yeah, I mean, you know, absolutely. I think, you know, it's a really good point because, you know, I can give you a very practical example. I went to help set up Morgan Stanley's investment banking office in India in 1993 when India was on the verge of bankruptcy, Today it has $80 billion in foreign reserves, and there's concern of our jobs going overseas to India. So we need to give the same advantages that India gave its small businesses, things like workers' compensation, all these other insurances. We need to make it affordable for small businesses. I know I built my companies, you know, from scratches of paper and grew them, and if you got to pay workers' compensation, you've got to pay health insurance, it just becomes very hard to compete in the global market. So whether, you know, the government kicks in some of the costs, or there's just, you make it more affordable to, you know, buy workers' compensation. If you're a large Fortune 500 company, the rates are probably a lot, you know, cheaper because of the large scales. I think we need to figure out a way to bring it, you know, down to that rate, or have the government help out.
Well, I would agree with that, because I mean it's not a cost that a small business can ignore. And if you're saying that most small businesses are small, you know, maybe less than 10 employees, that's a big number, and it would seem that should be something that's in the mix of healthcare reform. I mean, if you're planning on having small businesses create new jobs, you know, this tax cut of the president's seems to have helped, you know, the bigger companies, but for a smaller company, it just hasn't really trickled down. Can you address anything there?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think, you know, absolutely. I think that's, you know, what makes sense. I mean, what we need to do is, you know, is make sure the capital gains, the estate debt tax, but more importantly, you know, technology investment. If you make an investment in technology, you should be able to deduct it off your taxes. No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's because the small businesses are going to generate the majority of job growth in this country. Do you have a small business, or?
Yes, I no longer have an employee, but when I did, it was, quite a surprise to find how much it would cost to maintain an employee, you know, in terms of the quarterly taxes and the health insurance and the workers' comp, and it's a wonderful learning experience, but again, it's expensive, and I'd say it's, you know, it's kind of an obstacle for a small business person to, you know, really get involved in the process when they're hit immediately up front with a lot of these costs. So I'm just thinking that it might benefit startups if there was a way to kind of ease that entrance in some fashion. But more importantly, I think it should be part of the of the debate in the reform of the healthcare system, in that if there eventually might be some universal coverage. I mean, I'm not sure that there should really be a distinction between, you know, what happens at work or what happens, you know, when you're shopping. I'm not saying the bigger companies shouldn't put some money in, but I think it should be part of the debate.
Oh, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think small businesses are going to generate the majority of job growth, and we've got to give every advantage we can to a small business owner to grow, not to be burdened with, you know, taxes, overhead, and, you know, just like incorporating a small business, that takes a lot of time and cost. We just need to streamline a lot of that, and then we've got to, you know, basically help small businesses sell their products, whatever they may be, even small farm owners to, let's say, outside of Illinois to the rest of the states and to other countries and help them grow, because people like you are going to generate the majority of jobs in our country.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks very much for the call. We'll go on here. We have somebody up next in calling on cell phone, so we'll get right to them. Line number two. Hello.
Hello. I'm a small business owner, and I'm really excited to hear what you're saying about the importance of small business growth for increasing federal revenues. One of the things you just said about the problem with the Social Security system is of interest, because the Federal Reserve Chairman just yesterday suggested that a solution might be to start reducing benefits for it. The question I have for you is the tax cut that Bush enacted, about two-thirds of it had absolutely no stimulative effect at all upon the economy. The economists agreed that about 33% of it resulted in stimulus, and the other two-thirds was simply a direct wealth transfer from the nation's treasury to a very few wealthy individuals. And when the Social Security system 4 years ago was relatively intact, you know, the phrase was, put the money in a lockbox and leave it there. Well, obviously, the lockbox has been opened. The treasury has been emptied. I'd like to know if you're willing to campaign on the slogan of put the money back, Mr. Bush, and lock the box up again.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, absolutely. So let's, you know, let's take a look at some of the facts with Social Security. You know, it was basically based on life expectancy. In 1940, the life expectancy was 63 years, you know, and now, you know, in 1998, the figure has gone up to 76 years, and people predict, you know, by 2030, life expectancy will be just under 80. So, you know, the problem is that the average, retiree that receives Social Security benefits for a greater number of years.
Well, I certainly agree that's the economic basis for some of the problems, but what you're not alluding to is the fact that we didn't have this problem with nearly the severity that it is now 4 years ago.
Oh,
something changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
We know that we were secure for like 2030 based on the demographics you've just cited.
Oh,
and now it's changed.
Absolutely. So what we need to look at is exactly by creating personal retirement. Because see, right now, as you know, because you understand the system perfectly, is when you pay into Social Security that, you know, the government can invest the money wherever they want. There is no lockbox. It's basically an IOU. So if you create personal retirement accounts or the money that you put into Social Security and you put it into a lockbox, it's just like if you get a loan from a bank, they basically create a lockbox so they can control your spending. I think that makes perfect sense.
Well, I think in response, though, I would still say that the what is missing is the fact that the radical right wants to eliminate most of the government social service programs. That's what the radical right wants to do. The words of Oliver Norquist are, I want to get the government to the size where I can drown it in the bathtub. And when you talk about reducing Social Security inputs by taking 5% or whatever and putting it in a personal savings account, that goes right at the root of the Social Security system. You're picking an axe to it, and that's the wrong way to go. What we need to do is look at the demographics and then calculate what we have to do to fund what we have promised to the folks who, like my age, are a few years away from retirement.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, because I think it's for people like yourselves who have paid into Social Security and you've been putting money in all your life, you absolutely deserve, you know, the benefits that you were promised that came along with it. So I think, you know, one of my foremost interests if I get elected to the U.S. Senate is to make sure people who paid into Social Security get the benefits that they were promised. And we need to figure out a way to reform the Social Security system before it goes bankrupt so those benefits are there when you retire. Because every day we wait, you know, like you said, you know, you look on the front page today, you know, of the Chicago Tribune, you know, Greenspan issues warning, deficits will force Social Security, you know, cuts, Fed chief says. So I completely understand what you're saying.
No, you don't, because you haven't acknowledged that what the government is doing is taking the money out of the lockbox. The system is not in trouble. The deficit is causing the government to attack the surpluses that the Social Security system develops. That's the reason the system's in trouble, because the deficit spending, which Greenspan warned against yesterday, he said will cause us to dip into Social Security so it can't pay out what it promised. Well, what I say is the tax cut that was enacted is the problem, not how much we're paying into Social Security.
See, I mean, I think there's, you know, a couple of issues. I think, you know, you bring up a very good point. I think there's, you know, what's happening is if you look at some of the statistics, the people who are paying into Social Security as opposed to many years ago, there are less people paying into Social Security as the people that they are retiring. So how do you fix, you know, Social Security? If you're saying, so what are your solutions? I'm interested to hear what are your thoughts on solutions.
My thought is the government should keep their cotton-picking hands out of the Social Security money. They said that the system is safe until 2030 based on the inputs under current taxation system. That was perfectly valid and perfectly correct. What has changed is the government isn't keeping its hands out of the Social Security money. And so now Greenspan is saying the government has created such an awful fiscal box that it has to go into Social Security to keep itself solvent, or at least closer to solvent. And what I would like to hear you say is the government needs to go back to leaving their hands out of the Social Security money so that it will be solvent through 2030 the way it was 4 years ago.
See, no, exactly. See, just so you know, at least, you know, my understanding of the Social Security system is, let's say when you pay money into the Social Security, the government is free to invest it as you please. It doesn't go into a lockbox. So if you were to create, let's say, Social Security Part B, so you would have some more control on your money that you could put it or invest it and give it to your kids, that might make sense. And
well, that's part of the radical rights agenda to end Social Security by depriving it of its inputs. I think I've repeated myself, but you have to. I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, we do have another caller here that we can go on to. I don't know, Mr. Kathiri, any last point you'd like to make on that?
Yeah, I think, the caller has some very good points. You know, my belief is anyone who paid into Social Security definitely deserves the benefits. What you need to do is you need to reform Social Security very quickly so the system doesn't go bankrupt, so the people who are paying into it. And there are a couple of ideas. As the gentleman correctly pointed out, is when we pay into Social Security, the government is free to invest it. So by creating certain things, personal retirement accounts, that you can take control of your money and invest it in super safe treasuries, I think that makes sense. Having the money that you pay into Social Security and the government puts it away so they don't spend it so they can grow it, I think that makes a lot of sense. But the key thing is we need to understand that life expectancy has increased. There are less people paying into Social Security. Today, the Social Security deficit is twice our national deficit, and it'll go to $9 trillion. So what we need to do is we need to start reforming it right now so all the people who paid into Social Security are promised their benefits back and we can keep it solvent.
Let's go on. We have some other callers here. Next is Urbana. They're both Urbana. We'll take them in the order they came in, starting first with line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi. First of all, the author mentioned about budget cuts in our national budget. I was wondering why he didn't fail to mention the huge defense budget that could be trimmed. But that's not my quarrel. My quarrel is with I am an Indian. And I was born in Bangalore, and he mentioned about the Indian model. And I was wondering, pretty much, a regular Indian worker would make anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000, and rich Indians like the speaker himself would make about 40,000 or 50,000 rupees or even 60,000. So I was wondering, is he trying to imply that that's a good way to go at it? Or, I'm just failing to understand what he means by the Indian example.
Sure. I think if you take a look at it, because I think one of the key issues everyone talks about is outsourcing. I'm the first Indian American to run for the U.S. Senate, and I'm the only immigrant running in both races. So, to give everyone who's listening some facts, and then, I think this is a very good issue to debate and talk about is, when I went to India in 1993 to help set up Morgan Stanley's investment banking office, India was on the verge of bankruptcy. And
it wasn't. I don't believe it was on the verge of bankruptcy. But my question is that are you willing to bring the American worker to the level how the Indians treat their own workers? That's what I'm trying to say. In terms of benefits, you mentioned benefits. There is no such thing as benefits to an Indian worker. I don't understand. Your Morgan Stanley firm probably paid him what? What did they pay him?
Oh, no. So let's take a look at what happened with the Indian economy, because in 1993, India had about $10 million in foreign reserves. Today it has $80 billion. So the country, with what Manmohan Singh, put some economic stimuluses. What we need to figure out is that a lot of jobs are being outsourced to India. How do we protect Illinois businesses and grow Illinois businesses and give them some of the same advantages? For in Bangalore, for example, the government created these vast technology parks. If you exported software outside of India to the U.S., you weren't taxed on it. So we need to figure out how do we, you know, because it is a global playing field. How do we help, you know, small business, let's say, you know, in the U.S. expand into India, grow markets, which will also help, you know, Indian consumers, and at the same time figure out how do we deal with this issue of outsourcing. With what people need to understand, first of all, it's only 2% of the jobs are actually being sent to India. What we need to do is make businesses more competitive and give them some of the same advantages and take a look at what India did to grow its small businesses. So we weren't talking, I wasn't talking about, you know, the benefits or the salaries or anything along those lines.
Right, right. But another question, forgive me,
sure.
About the national defense.
Sure,
do you
sure,
believe in the current spending of the national defense, the way it is going?
Sorry, you just broke up a little bit. About the current spending of the national defense, go ahead.
Correct. Do you believe in the president's spending that much money on national defense and giving tax relief at such a time in our budget deficit? Do you believe in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, a couple issues. So first of all, let's take a look at, you know, the war on terror and defense spending. And then let's take a look, you know, at tax cuts and kind of break these, you know, two issues separately. And let's look at a specific example, you know, the war on Iraq. I think, you know, two of the things that, you know, that a nation's responsibility is to provide security for all their citizens. Now, if you look at what happened, you know, during 9/11, it was a very sad day in U.S. history. But since 9/11, America has been very fortunate not to have another attack on U.S. soil. And it's, you know, it's very sad what's happening with Israel, even though they have smaller borders, and they have a great intelligence force, is unfortunately suicide bombers keep happening. So we need to look at how do you fight the war on terror. I mean, things are changing. The days of the Cold War are gone. So for stuff, for example, you know, I was involved in helping send the first privately funded manned mission to space. We've got to use space and satellite for reconnaissance. Technology like that, you know, is very expensive. Now, the war on Iraq, I mean, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. Out of the $87 billion, the way I would have financed it, I would have the $22 billion, which was, you know, for reconstruction, financed as a long-term loan. The other part, I would have some more of the other countries in terms of the military share it. You know, my proposal now is going forward is for the next 6 months, have the U.S. there till we have a local Iraqi government, then followed by a U.S.-UN coalition, then followed by a U.N. But we also got to keep in mind what have been some of the positive effects. In Libya with Muammar Gaddafi, he's opened up his borders so we can look as if, does he have weapons of mass destruction? Is he developing a nuclear program?
Yeah, pardon me, excuse me, about Libya. I think what everyone is willing to take claim is that because of the administration's policy, Libya did that. Maybe we should look at it in another light. Maybe Muammar Gaddafi did it for his own favor. He was wanting to end the isolation himself. It's to his profit. Maybe we should look at that instead of taking credit for something we had no control over.
I mean, I think it's probably both. I think it's
definitely
ending economic isolation and also afraid of what happened in Iraq. So now if we look at, you know, the defense budget and tax cuts, I think historically, if you look at, you know, how much we're paying for the deficit, interest rates are very low. So we're actually paying a much lower amount, you know, for our budget deficit than we were before. I think that's something we need to keep in mind. I think historically the economy grew at 7.2%, which is one of the strongest growth rates in 20 years. So I think tax cuts historically have had a stimulus on the economy. I think, you know, my proposals, I wouldn't, you know, reduce the taxes anymore, but I definitely would not increase taxes. I signed a pledge that I wouldn't increase taxes. So I think reducing the capital gains tax, the debt estate tax, and certain things stimulates small business, which generates a lot of revenue to the economy. So I think, I think that's where you see a lot of growth rate is, you know, in terms of, you know, tax cuts, or at least keeping them permanent now going forward. And you got to remember dividends. That gives a lot of income to senior citizens. But, you know, go ahead, sir.
Yes. Hello?
Yeah, no, I'm here. I can listen.
I'm pretty sure you know a lot about economy and economic theories, this and that, but my fundamental problem with you is that you're obviously your view on this whole war on terror, the defense budget does not particularly go to these innovative technologies, but it also goes to the military-industrial complex. I'm sure you're aware of many companies who are benefiting from this, but also you mentioned Israel. Israel has one of the most sophisticated armies in the whole area, and I'm just curious. It's like the Palestinians throw stones at them, and they bring in the Apache helicopters. I'm just wondering how you would portray them as victims in this.
You know, I think there's, you know, a couple of things. If we look, you know, these are all very good questions. I think your point exactly is I think we need to spend money on homeland security and defense. I think it needs to be allocated correctly. Because, and I would definitely agree with you, if I was elected to the U.S. Senate, you know, as a business, when we deploy our capital, we look at what, you know, when we deploy our capital in different industries, what are the returns that we're going to get and what is our cost-benefit analysis? And I think that makes a lot of sense. We need to decide if we're going to increase our defense budget, where does it go? I mean, as a physician, I could tell you biological and chemical warfare is going to be something that we really need to pay attention to. You're right. If we want to develop space and satellite-based reconnaissance, you know, because our borders are so vast, we need to make sure the money gets spent there. If we need to use the National Guard to help patrol our borders, we need to make sure the money goes there. So absolutely, if we need to increase our, you know, our defense budget, I absolutely agree with you. We got to make sure it goes exactly where it is because there's a lot of incentive to increase the budget. But if you're not deploying it right, it doesn't make any sense. So I think that, you know, makes a lot of sense from what you were saying. In terms of your second thing with the Middle East conflict, I think we need to find a way, you know, to solve the Middle East conflict. You know, from, you know, just from, you know, a selfish point of view of America, cyclic shocks in the economy or when depression gets exaggerated or a recession is due to change in foreign oil prices and stability in the Middle East. So what we need to do and what Bush is trying to do or what America should do is educate that this is a war on terror, not a war on Islam. And one of the things I've always been preaching is, you know, education, you know, is extremely important, and also improving the economies. If we improve the economies of Palestine and other countries, we'll probably also reduce and help solve the Middle East conflict. I mean, you know, you're from India. It's what Gandhi said, an eye for an eye is going to make the whole world blind. So, you know, I think, you know, education, helping, you know, grow those economies, and the U.S. trying to stimulate, you know, Middle East peace, I think that makes a lot of sense.
We have less than 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I have several callers here. We'll try to get everybody in. I should also probably introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're speaking with Chiranjeev Katuria. He is one of eight Republicans that will be competing in the March 16th primary to represent their party in the general election for an open seat that we have here in Illinois for the United States Senate, that seat that's currently occupied by Peter Fitzgerald. We do have several people here lined up and ready to go, so let's go to the next in line, and that's Urbana, line number two. Hello.
As I was sitting here listening, I was getting distracted and counting the number of you knows per sentence. I think I got five and a couple of them.
That's a good point. I think you should be my speech coach. That's a very good point. I appreciate that.
But something that you should know is that the Social Security system is supposed to be a safety net. It is not supposed to be for passing money on down to children. It's to keep people from starving, which was a real problem when it was first introduced. And it's a pay-as-you-go system. Those of us who are working now are paying for the seniors who are retired now, and we're also paying for the war in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. It's not being put aside, the excess money that we're putting into the Social Security system. And if we have lower-paying jobs because jobs are from factory workers and call centers and so forth are going overseas, and people here have to find lower-paying jobs, that means less money into the Social Security system, on top of the fact that we'll have the next cohort coming along. The next age group is smaller in number than the baby boom. And then if you add into that, if you so-called privatize people's contributions into Social Security, that means that, you know, Wall Street isn't going to do this for free. That means on top of money that could be going to fund a Social Security, you're going to have money going to pay huge salaries on Wall Street. And the stock market companies and the mutual funds and the companies themselves haven't exactly been shown to be terribly honest. Have people been asleep with all the news that's been going on? I just can't believe it. I also haven't heard you say anything about the needs that this country has. Are we taking care of the children that we have in this country? I don't think so. There was an article in the paper last night about the consequences, the outcomes for children in the foster care system and how poor they tend to be. Why aren't we making sure, for instance, that we're taxing ourselves? If we care so much about right to life and human beings, why aren't we taxing ourselves to make sure that the children who are our joint responsibility are being cared for adequately so they have housing? Bush is cutting the funding for subsidized housing. People need a place to live. I don't hear anybody talking about taking care of people and sharing that burden around for people who were born into a system, into a world where they had no control over who their parents were. Thanks a bunch.
All right. Well, Mr. Katharia, you want to respond to any and all of that?
Sure. I mean, you know, for me, you know, running for the U.S. Senate, I wanted to figure, you know, America was very kind on me. You know, my parents came here with really little money. My dad sold life insurance for 35 years. My mom worked at the Veterans Administration. You know, and I was able to live the American dream. So for me is I want to listen to what people have to say. I think too often our politicians give their ideas and issues. I know as a doctor, you look at different tests, you do, you know, physical exams, and you kind of figure out what a diagnosis is. When you invest in a company, you look at all different factors from your due diligence. So for me, it's, that's what I've been doing, traveling around the state of Illinois, trying to understand what are people's concerns are. And if you actually go to our website, for all of these issues, we've actually tried to take a stab at it. What are our possible solutions? We just don't have 30-second answers. We've developed whole papers on Social Security, on education. And then, you know, before I answer these, so just so, you know, all these callers know how to get a hold of us and look at what we think on some of those issues, our website is www.Kathuria.com. And I tell people, you know, Governor Blagojevich won his race by teaching people how to pronounce his name, so I'm trying to teach people how to pronounce our name. But with Social Security, I think, you know, the caller, you know, is right. We need to figure out, you know, how do we deal with Social Security? There are less people paying into Social Security. As we talked about earlier, the average life expectancy has gone up. And people, and what people need to also remember is I think that we're getting away from the fact that Social Security is only giving a 1.3% rate of return, and a 38-year-old African-American will lose money into Social Security. So how do we solve all those issues? It's a complicated process. I think, you know, there are many ways, but we need to start this discussion immediately. My fundamental belief is unless you reform Social Security, all the benefits that were promised to seniors will no longer be there. You know, some of the possible solutions are by creating, you know, some type of accounts where you can create a voluntary Social Security Part B. And if you think about it from an economic point of view, you put it and that money grows, and that's there for you to take care of you during your golden years. And, you know, you can also pass it on. But, you know, we're open to looking at many other ideas. So the money you pay into Social Security, the government invests it. So it's not, you know, free to invest it like the one caller talked about is a lockbox. I think we need to really sit down and look at all the issues and have maybe, you know, a bipartisan commission so we come up with a solution. Because as we go forward, you know, they're the Democrats, the Republicans, and the independent voters, and you got to come up with the best possible solution. You know, on education, I can tell you that's been very important. I think education is one of our greatest equalizers. I wouldn't have been able to run for the U.S. Senate unless I was able to get a good education going through a public school system. And reading scores, have gone down in Illinois. And I think what we need to do is you take that the money that's at the Department of Education and maybe take 25% of that and bring it back to, you know, Illinois and to, you know, local states so they can invest it as they see fit. But I think education is absolutely important. It's one of the greatest equalizers in our country.
We have one more caller I want to try to get in here on our line number 4 down in southern Illinois. Hello.
I'm an immigrant, too, and I'm questioning some of the things. And I congratulate you for trying. This is great. I know that I wouldn't win. I did try one time, and I didn't win. It was exciting to see how many people liked me. I thought, people like me, but I didn't win. Okay, and I congratulate you. But you are talking, well, maybe being married to a Kennedy would help a lot. Have you considered that? American dream. The American dream. Tell me one thing, but then you're giving India as an example, and you're talking about the American dream. And India is a poor country, and they exploit the poor people. Is this what you are for? Trying to bring that? We do not want to exploit our poor. We want to bring our poor people up.
Yeah, we just have about a minute to
left
in the show.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the call. Ed, whatever you want to say, just to wrap us up here.
No, I think it's a very good question. I think, what's great about America and what's made America great is that we're all immigrants, and if you come and you work hard in this country, you can achieve the American dream. It's not like in some countries you have to be born in wealth or to be born in politics. My father tells me is that, it's amazing that his son can run for the highest elected office. It just shows the greatness of our country. And I think America helps improve all our economies. Indian Americans have come here. They've contributed a lot to America. In 15 years, they're the richest ethnic minority, provided a lot of jobs. I think, America has helped grow global economies across the globe. But I think, one of the major reasons I'm running is this is what makes America great. And that caller, was saying, I hope, the citizens of Illinois can celebrate their diversity and elect me to the U.S. Senate. Because I think, we need to diversify the Senate and bring the views of all of Illinois. To sum it up, I'm the only physician running for the U.S. Senate. I joke around about our candidacy. It's a little bit like the war in Iraq. The first phase, when people saw me with the beard and turban, they were a little bit shocked. When they found out about our background, they were in awe. And I've been working on the third phase, trying to win people's hearts and minds. But, I definitely appreciate you guys taking the call. And for me, these are very informative, because my idea is to meet as many people and to look at solutions, how we make America a better place. And that's the main reason for me running.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Again, for people who want to find out more about our guest, and if you have internet access, his website is www.kathuriaforsenate.com. And Chiranjeev Kathuria, thanks very much for talking with us.
I appreciate you having me.